meeting is being recorded.
This meeting is being recorded. There's Justice Brown. Good morning, Mr. Brown. Okay, where do I get this guy right here? All right, so we've got everybody so far that I got. And we've got 12 students. Okay, so let's get started. Share the screen back to the back to our portfolio. But let's first discuss the morning. It's the 30th of April, oh my goodness, and when the spring semester hits May, it's fast. It just seems to all of a sudden, zoom, May. Spring semester starts out, you know, pretty good, and then there's a bit of a lull in April, and then all of a sudden May comes and phew, it just flies by. So what do we have coming up? Today we're going to basically wrap up the entire semester by going back to the very beginning of the class and revisiting the idea of risk versus return. Now that we've covered in detail the major choices of stocks, bonds, mutual funds, short-term investments, okay? And so we basically put our arms around everything that are the most important in investment alternatives. And then we have exam number four on bonds, bond calculations. There'll be three questions on preferred stocks and convertible securities. We'll take a look at those. I already showed them to you. I'll show them to you yet again. And then asset allocation, diversification, which we're going to discuss today. So we have a lot to do today. And then tonight, we will go through the worksheet number 3 in chapter 10, which will be hint, 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 very much like the second portion, the calculations portion of exam number 4. So be forewarned, be forearmed, and let's get started now by taking a look at our portfolio. Which, folks, this is typical, you know, well, actually, this is not a typical bear market, what we're going through these days. It's very crazy, but still, this is what happens. You see what happens? We got hit, clobbered, went down 30-some percent, and now we're back up and to the point we're only down about 9%, which is typical, folks. I mean, the stock market that does it. And look, we've got two companies that are in the black, so to speak. They use what this sort of a cyan. But notice that our worst performer is the bank, the Wells Fargo, which is typical of a recession. Banks do get hit pretty hard, but they're not going anywhere. Coca-Cola, Berkshire Hathaway. I don't think that's a bad choice. But this one guy, this Renewable Partners. I'm not sure who was the person who Brookfield who recommended it, but considering that the whole energy sector has been literally destroyed, these guys are holding up pretty darn well. So you, all in all, you've done a pretty good job weathering the storm. And I hope it's been a good, so far, education. It ain't over yet, folks. No. I'm still expecting. Doesn't mean it's happened. I don't know what's going to happen. But I'm expecting us to have another very rough time. Because right now we're in the Wile E. Coyote stage. You know, when the roadrunner and the coyote runs off the cliff and he's there in midair and just looks around, and then he realizes that there's nothing underneath him. And that's where we're at. That's an image from Mr. Peter Lynch, by the way. Earnings are falling off a cliff. Earnings are literally going to plummet. And I think stocks are going to plummet too. But that doesn't mean I'm selling anything, folks. And I don't know when it's going to happen. It might happen tomorrow. It might happen next year. I don't know. I think it's going to happen sometime within a year. But that doesn't mean I'm right. We'll see. If we can come up with a vaccine, if we can come up with a treatment, there's a treatment that's already out there that looks very promising, a few others. Tens of thousands of very, very smart people around the world are working on a vaccine, a treatment, and testing, and they don't want to die. I mean, obviously, they want to make money, certainly. You know, people say, oh, they're going to make money. They're also going to keep themselves and everybody else from dying, so let's hope for the best from them. Okay, so enough of that. Now, let us now take a look at the website again. What did I do with it? I think I have to redo it up here. Yeah. And I wanted to remind everybody, if you go to the Introduction to Investments, that there are the three questions and answers about hybrid securities. That's all you need to know about hybrid securities, preferred stocks, convertible bonds, convertible preferred. That's all you need to know for our situation. Remember, the whole chapter is out there. You can go through it. There's a bonus assignment if you want to do it. You don't have to do it. It's very simple, but you don't have to go through the entire chapter because we don't have enough time or we have an unusual semester. And then here are all the questions, the Scantron portion, so to speak, multiple choice, true, false, and the answers are not there. You have to figure them out. You have to do the research. And also, when you take the exam in Canvas, as I warned you, the Canvas sometimes swaps the A, B, C, D. It just moves them around. Doesn't always do it. I don't understand the mechanism. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't when you upload it to Canvas. So do be careful. It might not. You might print this out and put the circle the A, B, C, or D, and then you just go ahead and click on them in Canvas. But be careful, because Canvas might have moved them around. So just be careful about that. And then here is the second part. Here are the calculations, the Chapter 10 calculations, and then the Chapter 6 calculations, which are very similar to the worksheet number 3, which we'll go over this evening. And depending how much time we have today, we could go over a couple of the problems today, or maybe not, if depending how much time we have. Okay, so cool, got that? All right. All right, so let's now go to the presentation. There it is. So present. Oops, that's not the one I wanted to hit. Come on, present this guy. And then close that guy. All right, so let's go back to... Here we are. Diversification and risky asset allocation. So again, there's a study guide. I would normally printed that out and copied it and made it, given it to the face-to-face students. Oh, we're up to 15. Let me stop for just a second and see who's here. Just I'm trying to do this to Carla here, Carla Guzman, and Manuel Flores. Is that Tamara? Tamara, is that you?
Yes.
Okay. It says Manuel Flores. Okay, thank you for coming, everyone. And Nate Hernandez is here. I think that's Nate. Nate Hezzy just showed up. Okay, great. Okay, because let's go back to sharing the screen. Okay, so again, there's a study guide. There is also an assignment for Chapter 11, and this one will be required. And we'll discuss it today, if we should have time to discuss the assignment today. It's not hard, it's just looking stuff up. But it's also revisiting the idea of risk versus return, risk versus reward, and diversification, which is a very cool thing. Diversification is not perfect, obviously nothing is, but diversification for the vast majority of us is a very good thing to aspire to. So let's get started. Okay, click here. Okay, good. Diversification is spreading your investments across a number of asset classes to eliminate some, but not all, of the risks of investing. We can't get rid of all risks. There's no one investment is risk-free, and all investments taken together are not risk-free. But you've heard the saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Well, there are people who say, put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket. And it's attributed to Mark Twain. Probably he didn't say it. A lot of things that are said that are smart are attributed to him. He did say a lot of smart things, but he also gets credit for some things that he didn't say. But I don't agree with the second one. Yeah, sure, you can put all your eggs in one basket and watch that. Whoops, that doesn't work. And watch that basket, but you could watch that basket crash and all your eggs get destroyed. So I'm not a big fan of that. Although there are some people who will tell you, no. I only invest in 4 or 5 different stocks that I have the highest conviction of. Great, That's great if they do well. Not so great if they don't do well. We want, if we're individual investors, we want at least to have 10 or 20. And we're going to see why in just a few moments here. Diversification. This is a chart. And I'm wondering if we should run, if we should, because this thing keeps showing up. Let me, you know what, I'm talking out loud here. My apologies. Nothing's perfect, speaking of which technology. So I'm starting up Putrid Point. I'm sorry, PowerPoint. And it takes forever to start up. That's one of the things I don't like about it. Come on, you piece of ooshk. Come on. Oh, boy. Okay, so I'm going to stop the share, and I'm going to go to this guy. And then I'm going to start the share screen with PowerPoint slideshow. How's that? That looks better. Okay. So does that look better now with that thing doesn't show up in the morning in the bottom here? Here are the market leaders from 1983 to 2013. And what we see are large company U.S. stocks, that's the S&P 500, global small company stocks, international stocks, foreign, emerging stocks, bonds, international bonds, foreign bonds, and cash. And what we see is no one asset class is done the best over the long term. We see that there was the time in the late 1990s when the U.S. large company stocks were just unbelievable. They were just exploding on the upside, up and way up. And then we see other times when emerging market stocks were doing much better. Look at the 2009, 80%. But at the same time, look at the down years for emerging market stocks. The volatility is very real. And then there's a few times when bonds actually did better than stocks, not too often. Not one time did cash ever do better than the best performer. And so again, that's yet another signal to us that sure, if we want to put our money, if we need our money in a year or so, short-term investments, cash investments, they're important because we don't want to lose, 20%, 37%, 50%. But at the same time, we're not going to gain if it's a long-term investment. So diversification has been one of the best methods to reduce risk. By moving your investments around these various asset classes, one of them is going to be doing well. One of them is not going to be doing well. So diversification guarantees that at least one of the things that you are looking at are going to make you sad, but there's going to be something else that'll make you happy. But notice who's been the most profitable? Emerging markets. They've also been the most risky. Yeah, and that only makes sense. Why? Because that's where the growth is, in the emerging markets. And I don't know if I told you about this little story. We call them developing markets, emerging markets. But back in the 1980s, the World Bank wanted, it's a division of the International Monetary Fund. They wanted to create a mutual fund, an investment vehicle for people to invest in the emerging markets. But they didn't call it the emerging markets then. They called it the Third World. They wanted to call it the Third World Fund. And this is, before a lot of you were born, we still had the First World, which was the West and the democracies, and then the Second World was the communist bloc, and then the Third World were the countries outside either of those two spheres of influence. And so the World Bank sponsored several different companies to come and talk to them about what they were looking for. And this was in New York. After the presentation, one of the muckety mucks from one of the very large money management companies got up and said, look, I think this is a a great thing that you're doing, but there's absolutely no way we want to be involved. It's going to be incredibly risky. It's going to have bouts of incredible, you know, volatility. And he was right. But he said, for God's sakes, don't call it the Third World Fund. Don't. And he was absolutely right. And this is when you started hearing in the 1980s, emerging markets, developing markets. And he was absolutely right. They were incredibly risky, but at the same time, very, profitable. Now, somebody has their mic on, so you want to turn your mic off because there's some background noise. So whoever that is, turn your mic off, okay? So, but we come back to the idea of how do we measure risk? Okay, somebody wants to turn off their mic. I can go to the managed participants and find out who it is. Yeah, I'll find out who it is. Okay, so who's got their mic on? Let's turn the mic. Mute. Giovanni. Mute. Okay, I must have hit it. I must have got the person. Okay. All right, so we've come full circle. Way back in chapter one, we introduced the tug of war between risk and return, risk and reward. We saw how the higher the average annual return, the higher the standard deviation and its companion measure variance from the average annual return. Sure, you're going to get a higher return from stocks, but you're going to have a higher variance, a higher deviation. It's going to vary from that return. And we studied mutual funds, stocks, bonds, short-term investments. We discussed the risks and returns of each. Return is easy to measure. How much did you start with? How much did you end with? That's how much you made, right? But risk is very difficult to measure. It's even harder to anticipate. 2008, at the end of 2018, and certainly now, 2020, with the coronavirus. I mean, who would have thought that this thing would circle the globe? We know in the past we've had these pandemics. We just didn't know when it was going to happen. The last major one was 100 years ago, and let's hope the next major one won't be for another 100 years. But the problem is, travel is far more, our technology has made travel far more easier, far more commonplace, so these bugs can move very quickly. So, what's going on? Why isn't it going to the next page? There we are. Variance and standard deviation. Variance and its more useful companion, standard deviation, tell us how much an asset class will vary from the expected return. These measures are readily available from the investment community, and the numbers ain't pretty. For any randomly selected stock on the New York Stock Exchange, the standard deviation is close to 50%. What does that mean? That means the most stable stocks, randomly selected, the one is going to vary up to or down close to 50% from its average annual return. So if a stock has an average annual return of 8%, right, it's a fairly reliable stock, that means it could be 12 or it could be 4% in any one year. But we know that to be true. How do we reduce the risk? We don't know what's going to be next year, but we know it's going to be very volatile. In other words, how do we reduce the risk? How do we reduce that variance? The answer, of course, is to diversify, which you intuitively understand, and we've talked about all semester. Because if we go from one randomly selected stock down to two, the standard deviation goes from 50% down to about 37%. If we randomly select 10 stocks, it goes down to about 24%. 20 stocks, 22%. And so on. Diversifying our stock portfolio reduces our risk substantially, as measured by reduced variance and standard deviation, which we know already is imperfect. So we know we're trying to measure something that we can't measure, but here's our best shot at it. So here is a table, and there's a graph next that we'll take a look at. I don't know if it's that great, but here you start adding stocks to your portfolio. You start with one, and you got 50%. 2, 38. 4, 30. 10.24%, 21.5%, 119.69%, but you add another 200 and you only go from 19.69 to 19.42. And you start adding more and more and more stocks. You see that there is a limit to how much we can reduce our our standard deviation, our risk metric. Excuse me, I need some water here. I'm okay. Don't worry. I'm okay. And you can't get the virus through the computer, I'm sure. Different type of virus. All right, so here's the graph. There is a limit. Come on, how do I get this? How do I get here? There is a limit to which diversification can reduce your risk in any asset class. In this case, stocks. So those of you who have taken math, you understand this is a hyperbola. Not a hyperbola. Yeah, it's a hyperbola. Yeah. This is a graph that shows that it doesn't matter. We keep adding more and more stocks. We don't really get much less risk. Why is that? And the reason is the term we use is correlation. Now, I want you to study this. I'm going to ask it. It's going to be on the exam. The questions are already in that handout. So study those questions in that exam. The correlation is the tendency of returns of two assets to move together. We watch these assets, in this case we're working with stocks, and we see that they have a tendency to move in the same direction. Excuse me. But the reason why diversification works is because they are not perfect. It's not perfect correlation. It's called imperfect correlation. That's the key reason why diversification reduces our portfolio risk, as measured by the standard deviation, because no two investment returns will be exactly the same. Assets, in this case stocks, are positively correlated when they tend to move up and down together. They're negatively correlated when they tend to move in opposite directions. And we've already discussed this. Didn't we say when stocks go up, bonds tend to stay, you know, where they are? Maybe they go up a little bit, maybe they go down. But when stocks go down, bonds tend to go up. That's negative correlation. So the correlation coefficient, which is one of the things we're going to ask you to take a look for in the Chapter 11 assignment, is a measure of how closely returns on assets move together. And they range from -1, -100%, to 0, to +1, 100%. If they're perfectly negative correlated, that would be -100%, -1. If they're uncorrelated, that would be 0, which means there's no correlation. One goes up, the other one stays the same, the other one goes down, the other one goes up. And there's just no rhyme or reason to the way they move together. And then if they're perfectly positively correlated, that would be 100%. That means if one goes up, the other one goes up. If one goes down, the other one goes down. And they use the variable R. Why do they do that? What does R have to do with correlation? I don't know. Why don't they use the word correlation? No, they use the variable R for correlation coefficient. So here are some graphs from the book that I don't think they're the best graphs, but here, these two asset classes here. Here's one, black, and then what is that? Like a gray or something like that. They both go up at the same time, and they both go down at the same time. Now, the one is more volatile. Number one is more volatile than number two, but they still are positively correlated perfectly. As one goes up, the other one goes up. When one goes down, the other one goes down. This graph shows you negative correlation. The one goes up, the other one goes down. Then the other one comes back up, this one goes down. So they have a perfect positive, and I'm sorry, perfect negative correlation. And you don't see usually perfect correlation. That's why we said imperfect correlation is the reason why diversification is helpful. And then this one is supposed to show zero correlation. I don't know if it actually does. But in other words, one goes up, the other one stays the same or goes down. It actually looks like they start off in correlation, but then they sort of go off on their very ways. So if we have a zero correlation, that means these two will just not be related to one another at all. We're not going to learn how to do these calculations. We just look them up. But they're not that hard to do, actually, especially if you like statistics. I'm sorry, statistics. So, slide number 12. How does this answer our question about why diversification can only reduce by so much the risks of owning stocks? Well, although stocks are not perfectly correlated, some will go up, some will go down, they are positively correlated enough so that stocks in general tend to move in the same direction, which we already know intuitively. That's why we often refer to stock investments as a whole as the stock market. How's the market doing? Even though at any given time, some companies are doing well, others are doing poorly, and many are simply just chugging along as they always have done. And you'll hear the term, a rising tide raises all boats. Right, how's the market doing? Because stocks are correlated with one another. That is why adding more stocks, we don't get perfect diversification. We don't get perfectly destruction of risk or reduced risk because they're correlated to one another. So you might say, darn, that's still too much risk for me. So I think I was going to stick to bonds, right? We understand that we know that bonds are far less risky. You're a very conservative, risk-averse investor, and you don't like the volatility of stocks. Therefore, you decide to place all your investments into bonds. You're going to accept a lower return from bonds in exchange for the lower risk of the bonds. Oops, oops, that's the bad idea. Why? Because, assuming this is, we're talking about longer term money. Because, like stocks, bonds are positively correlated with themselves. They also do tend to do well and do poorly as a whole. With, regard to what's going with interest rates, or maybe a recession. And they often are negatively correlated with stocks. As we said, stocks and bonds often, but not always, move in opposite directions. So if your goal is to just reduce risk, it makes more sense to have a blend of stocks and bonds. Here is a graph that hopefully it makes sense. Let's see if we can make sense of it. If you have 100% stocks, you're going to get the highest return over time, assuming the world doesn't end. But you're also going to have the highest amount of risk, as measured imperfectly by standard deviation. As you start adding more bonds to your portfolio, the risk starts reducing, and so does the expected return, what we'd expect. But there's an inflection point where when you get to the point where you've added enough bonds to reduce the risk so much that you've reduced the risk from stocks, but now you start introducing the risk from owning too much bonds. Plus, at the same time, you're reducing the expected return. So yeah, you're going to get much less return from bonds, but you're also going to get more risk than if you had a blend of stocks and bonds. Does that sound familiar? Remember the balance funds? And then here's that same graph in a table form. As we start reducing our stocks percentages, this is 100%, 95%, 90%, and start introducing 5%, 10%, 20% of bonds, our expected return keeps going down and down and down, as we would expect. And again, these are older numbers, so bonds are not returning 6%. Well, some of them now are. Some of the triple B bonds are returning more than 6%. Our standard deviation keeps going down as we introduce more bonds until we hit that inflection point, and then it goes back up because bonds are correlated with themselves and negatively correlated with stocks. A combination of stocks and bonds actually created a portfolio with less risk while earning you more return than just bonds. If you are seeking less risk, it not only pays to diversify within an asset class, meaning stocks, within bonds, It also pays to diversify among asset classes. This kind of relationship occurs with domestic and foreign stocks and bonds, although much less now than it did in the past. The world is far more global, Agent Orange notwithstanding. The Chinese are not our enemies. If they are, then the world is going to end. Really, folks, in World War III, the first few hours, 100 million people, 500 million people, billion people are going to die very quickly. So let's hope that never occurs. Although diversification is still not a guarantee of positive results, no diversification scheme worked well in 2008 unless your idea of diversification was money market and treasury bonds. Everybody fell down. But we know that's going to happen. We just know that those things are going to happen over the long term. If the world continues to do well after we've vanquished COVID-19, I'm real positive. We have a name for choosing the appropriate mix for an investor. It is called asset allocation, which is a fancy term for how much should I have in stocks, how much should I have in bonds, how much of each stock, how much of each bond. There's an age-old formula where you subtract your age from 100, but now you hear people say 110, 120. That is the percentage of stocks you should own. The rest should be in bonds. So for example, a 40-year-old would have 100 minus 40, or 60% invested in stocks, 40% invested in bonds. A 60-year-old, 100 minus 60 is 40, so they should have 40% in stocks, 60% in bonds. Well, I believe that's poppycock. It worked 100 years ago when people just didn't live that long. You know, people used to retire at 62 and die at 64. Or they never made it to retirement in 65. Maybe their retirement was 65. But now people are retiring at 62 and going back to work at 64 because they're bored, or they got called up for, hey, we need you. We'll pay you pretty good. You just work for 3 hours or 4 hours a day. Or they got an idea for a business, starting a business. The fastest percentage group starting businesses now are people in their 60s. Now, the COVID virus notwithstanding, we're going to beat it, but people are living into their 90s. And you younger folks, 100 should be just de rigueur. It should just be something that is very normal for people. Supposedly, the first person to live to 150 has already been born. Now, I don't know. I'm not going to be around for that. But some of you will be. And I think it's exciting. I think it's pretty darn cool. So this, notice that they raised the number to 110, 120, because people are living far longer. So here is an example. We'll come back to this in just a minute here. Here's an example of allocation. You got 100 grand. How should you divvy it up? Well, some people would say you should have, some people will say this. It doesn't matter what your age, you should have some in bonds. So say you're 25 years old, they say you should have 25% in bonds, right? 100 minus 75 is 75% in stocks, 25% in bonds. I think that's ridiculous. You're 25 years old, you shouldn't have any bonds. But that's me, right? And I know this, and I teach this, and I know that, you know, as long as you don't panic, your bonds are going, oh, sure, they're going to do okay, but the stocks are going to do a hell of a lot better. So here you have 25% in bonds. How about 15% high-grade corporate junk bonds, assuming you don't need any muni bonds for tax purposes. If you were in a high-tax bracket, you'd like to throw some muni bonds in there also. But let's assume we don't need them because we're going to get paid better because we're in a low-tax bracket. If you're a little bit of risk tolerant, you want to take a little bit of junk bonds, a little bit of high yield bonds, and then outside the United States, 5% of your portfolio, $5,000 global bonds. 75% stocks, $75,000, 25%, $25,000, 25%. You see, I'm a big fan of growth and income, domestic and global. And then, so that's 50% of your plate is, and I think it should be more personally, but this is a decent example. And then, you know, 10% aggressive growth, 10% international, 5% small company stocks. You like it? It's yours. Or there are several different variations on this. You know, many variations you can come up with. But the idea is One of them is going to do well. One of them is going to do pretty poorly. And that's one of the problems with diversification, but also one of the great assets of diversification. Because something is going to make you sad, but that's okay. Something's going to make you happy. If you put everything into aggressive growth stocks, oh boy, could you be happy. And oh boy, could you be sad. And if you panic, oh boy, that's going to be the worst time for you to sell. But you already know this, dear students. I am so proud of you. So, how do we put this into action? Some of those same advisors that suggest asset allocation also suggest the technique of rebalancing. In fact, most all mutual funds have an option for you to rebalance automatically. You click a little box, and every 6 months or every year, their computers will allocate, rebalance your portfolio according to some formula they have. I find they tend to be too conservative, in my humble opinion, for young people. But obviously, if you're older, this could be a godsend. If you don't want to do it yourself, or you don't want to have a financial manager, let the mutual fund company do it. And they're going to make sure they do it fairly conservatively, because they don't want to get sued, right? Every year, what you do is you check to see if your percentages are still in balance. If stocks have had a banner year, you might now be 70% stocks, 30% bonds, instead of your target 60% stocks, 40% bonds. You would then sell enough stocks and buy enough bonds to bring the balance back to your target 60-40 allocation. Likewise, if stocks have tanked, probably bonds have gone up, interest rates have fallen, it's a recession, stocks get hammered, bonds do well and interest rates go up. Go down, and bond interest rates go down, bond prices go up. And then, so you sell your bonds and stop, buy some stocks to bring the percentage back up to 60% in stocks, 40% bonds. So you see, it's forcing you to do the right thing. It's forcing you to buy low, sell high. The stock market's on a tear. You want to sell stocks? No, it feels good. You're looking at your portfolio and it's doing darn well. Why would you sell now? Because that's what the history tells us to do. Now it's time to take some money off the table. Stocks have had a very poor year. Ooh, who wants to buy? No, now's the time to buy. Oh. You with me? You see that? You see that happens? So that's some. And I actually am a big fan of rebalancing, especially if you're older and you are doing your own, you're doing your own individual investing of individual stocks and bonds. Yes. But most people aren't doing that. So, stocks and bonds in retirement. So, we've been discussing the accumulation phase all throughout the semester. Now, we're going to turn our attention to how do we sell this stuff? How do we actually create an income for ourselves from our nest egg? Many advisors suggest that retirees shed the bulk of their stock investments in favor of bonds and cash investments. You know, that was great 50 years ago, 100 years ago. But the problem is people are living much, much longer. And the statistic is a 50-year-old living today has a 50-50 chance of living to see 100 years old. As you near retirement, start migrating your investments from stocks to bonds, but don't abandon stocks entirely. So we're going to take a look at some illustrations. You've seen these before. They were how we build up our nest egg. We're going to see how we pay it down, how we bring it down by withdrawing stuff. Okay, so let's stop the share here. My apologies. And see who we've got. Anybody new? We got Aaron Ramirez. Mr. Ramirez is here. And Janet's here. We lost Mr. Ruiz. Who else? Oh, Melissa. Good to see you, Melissa. Very good to see you. Okay. Anybody else I'm missing? Oh, Mr. Rincon. Very good. Okay. The Chinese are buying everything. Yeah, well, they're buying low. That's smart. But we're still in for some for some rough time. Well, we'll see. We'll see. I believe we still are in some rough time. So now let's go share the screen and back to the... Where is the... There it is. There's the... here is the... where's my website? Here it is. Okay. Back to the browser. So we're going to go back to the class website. And now let's go down to chapter 11. So here we have... Whoops. Chapter... Oh, no, it's chapter... Again, here's chapter 18. There are the three questions on the exam. But you don't have to go through the presentation if you want to. The assignment is optional. There's the optional bonus assignment. So here we have four different scenarios. We're going to, in each of the scenarios, start with $500,000. We've built a nest egg of $500,000. If you start early, dear students, and you start putting away $50, $100 a month and then raising it, we saw that you can do a whole lot better than $500,000. But that's not a bad, if you do that, you should be very proud of yourselves. So let's start with bonds and retirement. This is what people were told 50 years ago, 100 years ago. Oops, too many. You put all your money in bonds when you're ready to retire, which was made sense then because you only had about 5 to 10 years to live. But now you have 30 years, more to live. Some of you, 40, 50 years in your retirement. Investments are not FDIC insured, nor are they deposits of or guaranteed by a bank or any other entity, so they may lose money. Futures are not results and not predictive of results in future periods. All this stuff that nobody reads, it's supposed to scare you. So let's go through that and let's start. We're starting with a $500,000 nest egg. And we're going to go back 25 years. This is a generic bond fund. How can you get much more generic than it? Bond Fund of America, right? And we're going to start withdrawing 5% annually. So that's $25,000. And then every year, we're going to increase our withdrawal rate by 3%. So not 5, 8, 11, no, not like that. We just start with the $25,000, and then next year we'll do $25,000, 3% more than that, you know, 1.03%, 1.03 times that. And so it's only, we're starting in April. So that's why we don't see $25,000 the first year, because we're only doing it for 8 months out of the year. But still, 9 months of the year, from April to the end of the year. But so you see, starting 25,000, 26, 27, and this is a bond fund. And so we don't expect it to go up that much, but it turns out that 1995 was a great year to start, because 94 was the, before you get to 2008, was the last year that bonds had gone down. They consistently went up. So you see, our nest egg is doing pretty darn well going up, until 2007, and then 2008 comes along, and the first time since 1994 that bonds had fallen. But we're still, we come back somewhat, but then, but notice we're withdrawing more, because inflation, we want to take the grandkids to Disneyland or whatever, go on a cruise. And so after 25 years, our initial nest egg has produced over $900,000 of income. But we see that it's dwindling now. We're down to 229. And we've returned 5.85%, which is, you know, kind of what we expect, 6% for bonds in the past, not what we're going to see in the future, especially with the Treasury 30-year paying over 1.25% or something like that. But here's our graph. And we see that our nest egg is doing fairly well. You know, it's on a kind of, what was that, 1999. It went down a little bit, but still, because we're taking more money out. But then there's 2007 and 8, bingo. And now we're really dipping into the principal. But that's what we just expected. That is what was expected in the past. But we know, you dear students, because you've taken Business 123, you know that stocks over the long term have to do better than bonds. And so you're willing to stick it out and you're going to put everything into stocks. I don't recommend it. I ain't doing it, even though I know that they should do well. I'm old. So that's too big. Oops, there we go. So here's that same mutual fund. Be very afraid that we looked at in chapter 4, the Investment Company of America. Again, another generic mutual fund that's been around for over 80 years. And we start with that same nest egg, 500,000. taking 5% out annually and increasing by 3%. So the same withdrawal, we're going to get the same amount of income out of our portfolio, a little over 900,000. Our 500,000 is going to turn into 900,000. But we're going to expect more volatility. Well, of course, we're investing in stocks. And sure enough, the end of the 1990s, they went in two directions, up and way up, until after 2000, we had 1.1 million. But then 2002 came along, 2001, 2000 to 2002 bear market, and we lost 200,000, right? Went down 200,000. But we didn't run, we didn't hide. And look, we're back up. 2007, we're up to 1.4 million, and then 500,000. And you're in your late 70s now, and you're going, no, but you didn't run, you didn't hide, and it came back, and your nest egg produced 9.74%. You've got almost $1.2 million, and you started when you were 65, and you're now 90. You're sitting pretty, right? But could you stomach that volatility? Probably not. And you'd probably start taking more money out because you're 90 years old. But you see, this is what we'd expect from a stock portfolio, right? You see the roller coaster. But now we start to see that exponential curve starting to rise. But it's been a very volatile run. And would anybody do this in their retirement? Some people probably yes, but personally I'm not. You know, I've been moving, as we'll see. I'm going to tell you what I've been moving it to. I'm going to show you in a minute. But I still have a lot of money in stocks, even though others would say, no, Piano, you're too risky. I said, no. It doesn't matter. If the world ends, then it doesn't matter. We're all going to die. So now let's go to adding the two bond, the stock and the bond fund together. So remember, we started with the 500,000 in the bond fund. We had 220,000 at the end. Stocks, we had almost 2 million. We had a whole lot more volatility. Now what if we put together the stock fund and the bond fund? We'll take the both funds that we just looked at and start with 250 in one, 250,000 in one, 250,000 in the other. And so that's, where is it? Where does it say that? Yeah, here it is. It starts 250,000 with one, 250,000 another, and we're going to pull from each, which is probably what you wouldn't do. You'd probably pull more from the stock fund than you would from the bond fund, but we're going to pull exactly from each the same amount, 5% starting at the beginning, and then 3% of that every year. So we're going to, again, wind up with the exact same amount of withdrawals, 900,000, but notice we've done better than the bond fund. Nowhere near as well as the stock fund, but we've done better than the bond fund. But as we'd expect, it's been a little more volatility involved. By the 2007, we had a million, and then we lost 300,000. Well, went down 300,000. We didn't sell. And so we did better by having the stock and the bond fund together than the bond fund, not as well as the stock fund. But we still see some volatility, right? Because of those stocks, we still see some volatility. Right, this is showing you what the bond fund did. This is showing you what the stock fund did. So it's mostly the stock fund that increased the volatility. So that wasn't bad, was it? We still had some volatility to deal with, but definitely less than the we didn't measure the volatility, but less than all stocks. We only went down 300,000 instead of 500,000. But now this is what I was going to get back to. This is what I've been doing personally. You know, it doesn't mean you should do it, but I've been putting more of our new money, my wife and mine, into balanced funds, both specifically a domestic and a global, more of the global, but still leaving a lot of stuff in the stock funds. So do you take that for what it's worth? You know, that doesn't mean you should do it, but that's what I'm doing. Okay, so we've got the, again, be afraid, be very afraid. Now this guy, again, we're using very generic bond funds, very generic mutual funds. We had the Bond Fund of America, the Investment Company of America, and now we have American Balance Fund, which has been around in one form or another. It says 1975, but that's when this company took it over. It's been around in one form or another since 1937. And so we're going to start with the same amount, 500,000 Okay? We're going to take 5% out a year, increasing by 3%. And again, we're going to wind up with this same withdrawal amount, $900,000. But look at what our bottom line is. Look at how well it's done. It hasn't done as well as the stock fund, but pretty darn close, right? 9.11%. It's done better than putting the bonds and the stock funds together. Done a hell of a lot better than the bond fund. But we've still had some volatility. It went up to, look at that. It in 2001, 2002, it just went down a little bit here in 2002. Not very much at all. Much decreased volatility. And we lost about $300,000 here, which is what the balance fund and stock fund together, the bond fund and the stock fund lost about $300,000. But we wind up with a better overall nest egg by allowing the mutual fund managers. This is why, and be careful with your balance fund, because some of them are closet market timers. These guys, and they're not the only ones, these guys are well run. What they do, and we've talked about this before, they never go more than 75% stocks, 25% bonds, never less than 50% stocks, 50% bonds. So you see, they're doing their own little rebalancing as they see the markets. As they see great opportunities in stocks, they will reduce their bond exposure, increase their stock exposure. If they see that stocks are way too high, they'll reduce their stock exposure, increase their bond exposure. So they're doing the rebalancing automatically as they see opportunities arise. And they have, now I don't expect, folks, if you get 9% out of a bond, out of a balance fund, you thank your lucky stars. I don't expect them to be able to do this going into the future. Why? Simply because bonds are just not returning what they used to return. And so, but that doesn't mean they won't. Maybe they'll do better. Who knows? You know, that's why they call it the future. But it's a pretty darn good track record. And we see still some volatility, but nowhere near as much as what we saw when we only went with stocks. So how's that? Is this any questions, any thoughts? I'm burbling on for 45 minutes and maybe nobody knows what he's talking about. But to me, this is really good news. And so study these guys, and of course, there's an extra video for you to watch if you want. And so, cool. All right, let's stop for just a second and see who we got here. Anybody new? I think we got at least one person new. I can't find them, but that's okay. No big deal. Alejandro? Yeah, Alejandro is new. Okay. Okay, so any questions, any thoughts? Let's stop for a second. Okay, back to the slideshow. Okay. Oops, come on. That's the wrong one. Okay, here we go. So here we are. This is where we were, right? This is where we were. I apologize. I had accidentally moved the slides forward. So this is where we were in the presentation. We now see the advantages of putting stocks and bonds together in retirement. We'll be able to sleep well, fairly well, although there's going to be some nights. And we'll be able to eat fairly well, a lot better than if we just put our money in bonds and cash. Here's another example here. Here are stocks versus bonds versus a balanced approach. So here's stocks. Notice the stocks typically do a bit better than everybody else. This is just large company stocks. Here's the S&P 500. Here are United States bonds. Here's 60% stocks, 40% bonds. And then here's the Lipper Balanced Index. These are an amalgamation of balanced mutual funds. And notice the stocks typically do better, but are the stocks going to fall? Are the bonds going to fall 37%? No. What's the worst? You know, 2.9%. 2013 minus 2% in bonds. But here, when we put stocks and bonds together, we never are going to, well, one time do we beat the bonds and the stocks together. But every other time, we're never going to be the winner. But then again, we're never going to be the bottom, are we, either? And so having a balanced portfolio means that you almost never have the best returns in any one year. However, it also means you will very rarely ever have the worst returns in any one year either. In addition, although it is very unlikely that you will not equal or surpass an all-stock portfolio, you should, no guarantees, do better than an all-bond portfolio. But you already know we're going to add, right? No guarantees. So, let's go back to the... there's one more I wanted to show you. Go back here. So stop share. And then I wanted to show you the... share the screen back to the... guy here, right here. Back to the browser. And I wanted to show you this guy right here. This is Fidelity's take on it. And I don't think this is a very good example that they created. But it's a little hard to watch. But what I want you to look at are the ones that are white here. These guys. Where it says diversified portfolio. What they did is they took, you know, 9 different asset classes. And they put them together and gave 10% to each asset class. Well, that's dumb. Just dumb. You don't equate... U.S. small cap with U.S. large cap. You should have more large cap. In my humble opinion, other people might think I'm wrong. But the idea is, notice the diversified portfolio is almost always here in the middle. One time it makes it to the rank number three. I'm sorry, two times it makes it to rank number three. And then one time it makes it to the third worst rank. But you'll always be somewhere in the middle, which means that you won't be bragging about how well your mutual fund did or your stock portfolio did at people at a party. But at the same time, you won't be crying in your beer when things get really poor. And then, real quick, let's once again revisit that bonus assignment we discussed in Chapter 4, where we ask you to go out and see the diversification that's in the S&P 500. This is actually a couple years old, but still, they called it the S&P 500. It's more like the S&P 50. When 56% of your returns just come from 10% of the companies, is your index diversified? And this is the one thing that I've been asking people who are just, you know, they're like little robots. Oh, the S&P 500. Just invest in the S&P 500. And I say, but do you actually know what's in the S&P 500? Oh, yeah, it's the 500 largest companies in the United States. And I say, okay, well, do you know how well diversified it is? Oh, yeah, it's got 500 different companies. Fine. And then I say, okay, you know, look at the top 10. And what are you talking about? I don't know how to do that. And then so take my class. No, forget it. I'm not going to do it. So are you with me? Okay, cool. All right. So yeah, diversification is a good thing. And sometimes people don't even realize they don't have it. Okay, so back to the slideshow. So, now, this brings us back to dollar cost averaging. This is something we discussed back in Chapter 4. And now I want you to memorize this. Memorize these next couple of slides. Why? Because this is going to make a whole lot easier, folks. A whole lot easier to deal with. And not so much worrying about what's going to happen. A system of buying an investment at regular intervals with a fixed dollar amount. $50, $100, more as you go up. Notice, remember we said $100 and then $110 the next year, $120 a year after that. With dollar cost averaging, there's always good news. Good news, the market's up. Yippee! Yeah, your $100 is now worth $100.25 or whatever. Good news, the market's down. Yes, because next month you get more shares at a lower price when the $50 or $100 comes out of your paycheck or checking account. This is what I used for my wife, you know, a long time ago when she was so worried about, why are we investing in stocks? I said, because no matter what happens in the morning, there's good news. Okay, Payano, yeah, sure. All right, so here's an example. You invest $1,000 every year for 3 years, which is not typical. Most people are going to put in, you know, $100 or whatever a month, whatever. But the first year, it's $10. Yippee. And you get 100 shares. The second year, it's $5. Oh, my goodness, it lost 50%. 2008. and you get 200 shares. The third year, it's come back. Well, 2009 actually came back 30%, but not 50%, but this came back 50%. So you have $7.50, so you get 133.3333 shares. So you have a cumulative shares of 433.333 shares, okay? So you look at this and you figure, well, I broke even, right? I bought some at 10, I bought some at 5, and I bought some at 750. And the answer is no. You actually did better than break even. Your average cost per share is only $6.92. The $3,000 that you put in divided by 433.333 shares. The average price per share was $7.50. Sure. Although it looks like you should simply have broken even, you actually made money because you bought more shares at the lower prices, fewer shares at the higher prices. The value of your portfolio is $3,250. You see, it seems like magic, but it's not. It's just very straightforward. You always are putting in $100 a month or whatever, $1,000 a year or whatever, and sometimes you're buying shares when they're high and sometimes you're buying shares when they're low, and your average cost per share, this is what I want you to memorize because it's a little tricky, your average cost per share should be lower than your average price per share. But look, it's not a guarantee. It's not going to help you if you keep buying this lousy investment. Oh boy, look at boy, I'm buying more shares. It keeps going down. Again, until finally it goes to zero. The cool thing is that it just makes investing very easy, especially for mutual fund investors. With stocks and bonds, it's a little trickier, right? You don't have, you know, $500 or $600 to buy a stock, to buy 10 shares or 7 shares or whatever a stock. So you put $50 a month into your account, into the money market, and then when you get enough to buy, you know, a goodly amount of shares, go ahead and buy them. And people say, well, I don't pay a commission at all. Yes, you do. Even though you're not paying Robinhood a commission, you're getting, you know, if you buy fewer shares, you're getting not getting the best price. So it's better to, you know, get up about $500 or $600 more if you can afford it, and then buy your shares. But you, people will tell you different things. But I think that's what I think is at least that much. More if you can afford it, obviously. But that's why mutual funds are so easy. You buy with $25 or $50, you buy 25 cents of Apple and 30 cents of Home Depot and whatever. So speaking of mutual funds, wasn't diversification one of the two main reasons why my investors choose mutual funds? Yes, and the other was the professional money management. So does this mean mutual funds necessarily have less risk than an individual portfolio or the market as a whole? Well, it depends. It depends on which mutual funds we're talking about. So that's of our assignment. Our assignment is to go to Morningstar and enter a mutual fund and find the risk factors, the risk measurements that we can use, specifically the standard deviation. And then they throw in a few others, the alpha and the beta. But then the one that I really like, I'm going to show you, is the upside-downside ratio. And some of you have already done this. So this is review, which is good because now you see it from a much more broader perspective. You're not just seeing the mutual fund. You understand what's behind the mutual fund. And some mutual funds are more aggressive and some are less aggressive and more conservative. And you understand what kind of stocks that they're buying or what kind of bonds that they're buying. So let's go now to the worksheet. I'm sorry, the assignment. So stop the share. Sorry, I'm bouncing back and forth. Share to the, where was it? This guy right here, right? Where is it? Yeah, this guy. No, not this guy. This guy right here. Beep. Okay, so now let's go to Morningstar. Let's go to the assignment. Let's take a look at the assignment sheet. Okay, so the assignment sheet, real fast. Make this come on big. Oh, there, view. I'm sorry. View, zoom, 25%. Okay, so we're going to use Morningstar, or I think they used to have more stuff in Yahoo, but I think they took it away. It was coming from Morningstar. So we're going to find the standard deviation for 5 mutual funds, and the default is 3 years. We want you to choose 10 years, but you can do 3 years, 5 years. It's up to you. Okay, and then they're going to. I'm asking you to check the alpha, beta, and R squared, the correlation coefficient. There's the R value, and research what alpha and beta means. But here's the one I like. I like the upside-downside ratio. Okay, and then check out if their performance was high, low, moderate, compared to their category averages. So again, here are some really good mutual funds. Here are some not so good mutual funds. And be careful because Morningstar is going to try to get you enrolled. So I'm on Morningstar. So I'm going to show you one of my favorite mutual funds. And I'm not suggesting you buy this mutual fund because it's mostly United States based. If you're young, I think you should be global. But this is one of my favorites. It's called Washington Mutual. And why do I like it? Because they invest in the bluest of the blue chips. Does that make sense? They invest in the companies with their roots deep in the economy. They're kind of stodgy. They're not going to do as well as a growth-oriented portfolio, but that's okay. They're not going to be as, right, you got it, as risky. So we come here and we see that they give you the information that we've already taken a look at, and they show you how well they've done compared to the index. And you'll notice that they have not beat their index. They don't tell you right off the bat, but it's probably the S&P 500, which makes sense because even though they've beaten the S&P 500 over decades, the last 10 years have been very unusual. It's been growth the last 10 years, and that makes sense. But at the same time, they're going to exhibit less volatility, as we'll see if we go to risk. And so risk, and again, we like to see 10 years. So this is the, so there's the alpha, the beta, there's the standard deviation. See, the standard deviation for this mutual fund was 12.13%. You compare them to their category, though, their category is 13.89%. So I'm going to go back to 3 years. Was it? No. Yeah, no, 10 years, doesn't matter. So you see, they have been less volatile than their peers. And now then check out what alpha and beta means. This is actually good. When it's more than zero, that's actually good. And the category has actually been less than zero, so that's not good for the category. So they've beaten the category in that respect. But read about what, don't worry about them. They're not going to ask you about them. But read about what alpha, beta, and there's the R squared. Their correlation coefficient, 96.22%. That's how much they are correlated with their category, with their peers. And their index. They are about, with the index is 100%, they're 96.22%. So notice the upside-downside ratio. The upside ratio is 90, which means that they capture the upside of the Standard & Poor's. Oh, no, here's the category. They're using the Russell 1000 Trust. Okay, that's their index they're using. I'm not sure, I don't know too much about the Russell 1000. That's probably the 1,000 largest companies here. Okay, so they capture 90% of the upside. But on the downside, you see, they capture 88% of the downside. So they don't go up as much when the market goes up, but they don't go down as much. Whereas the category captures 97% of the upside, but the category captures 106% of the downside. Which means yes, they do poor. Their peers, their sisters and brothers, capture more of the downside. And I try to stay away from mutual funds that have a bad downside ratio. And then here's another excellent fund, Fidelity Contra Fund. I think we've discussed this Fidelity Contra Fund in the past. It's run by a brilliant man. And what I'm going to show you how good this guy is. Now, what scares me about this mutual fund is he's going to retire or he's going to die. He's getting old. He's like me. So if you look at his risk, and let's take a look at the 10-year. Look at that. It captured 97% of the upside, but only 87% of the downside. Is that cool or what? Sure, it didn't do as well, and they did the same thing here. The Russell 1000 Growth Index. It didn't do as well, not it didn't do as 100% of the index, but at the same time, when the index went down, it captured far less of the downside. It didn't go down as far. And to me, that's gold. That is gold. That's what I love to see in a money manager. I don't care how well. I want you to do well on the upside, sure, like everybody else. But I want you to really do well on the downside. And that is, to me, that is that's really cool. Okay, so that's what I'm going to ask you to find. And here, look at the alpha. This is awesome. 1.97%. This guy's done really, really well. Read about Mr. Will Danoff. And if you go online, check out some of his interviews. He's cool. He knows what he's doing. But he's going to retire eventually. Okay, so let's go back to the presentation. Slideshow. All right, now. Okay, so you do that. Now, here. Mutual fund investors have typically been really, really stupid as a whole. That doesn't mean you will be, and I know you won't be because you've taken this class and you understand. But we made the mention back in Chapter 4 that mutual fund managers tend to chase the return of the past year or two. So here we have, you know, the late 90s when the stock market did really, really well, and what had happened? The green is are the inflows or outflows. As the market did really, really well, what did people do? They started piling money into mutual funds. And then we had 3 years in a row when the market went down. And you notice that the inflows are going down and down until finally, after the third year, people start taking the money out. We start seeing net outflows right before the market explodes on the upside. And what do people do? They rush back in. And then we see the market crash in 2008. What do? They pull their money out. Do not do this. And so we see the same thing happen in here. People, you know, after 2009, 10, 11, people just start putting a little bit of money in, and then they jump out in 2011. And 12 and 2013, the market exploded on the upside. So many market historians have observed the tendency of mutual fund inflows and outflows to be a fairly reliable contrarian indicator of market performance. When people start putting their money in wholesale into the market, that's usually an example. That's usually an indicator that it's going to fall. Not always. And then the same thing is true when people pull their money out after the market's fallen. That's the sign when, oh, it's going to get better again. So, yet again, we've seen the danger of following the crowd. That's why the dollar cost average is just so cool, because you don't care. $100 a month, next year $110, $120, and we're done. We're done the entire semester, dear students. We've done everything we need. Well, not really. Okay, we're going to have some odds and ends in the last couple of weeks. Most of these I hope you never touch. Options, futures, shorting, buying on margins. Stay away from them. But instruction about syphilis is not an instruction to get syphilis. And that's why we need to learn about these guys, if only to help our poor sucker brother-in-law who comes in and says, I just heard about options, and this guy says I can make 100% in one day. And then you can lose it all the next day. And you want to make sure you explain to him or her that they're very dangerous, because you're the investment guru now for your friends and family. It is a very weighty and serious responsibility. Okay, so let's stop the share. Whoa! So the sharing window is closed. Okay, I did it for me automatically. All right, so now we are ready to... we got about 10 minutes left. Not quite. Any questions, any thoughts? Anything, anybody want to go over one of the problems? Or we have about time for one problem. Or discuss the exam again. Those of you who weren't here, we'll show you again what's going on here. Here it is. This is it, right? Yeah. In the worksheet, not the worksheet, in the website, and how do you get to the website? I still get some people go, how do you get to the website? It's what's the website? Wonder Professor, Business 123, Introduction to Investments. And then notice, here is exam number 4, starting tonight, 6 o'clock, available till Sunday. please don't wait until Sunday night. Please contact me if you want to go over the, we're going to go over tonight, worksheet number 3 in chapter 10, which is similar to the second part of exam number 4, which is, here it is right here for your edification. Here are the questions and answers on the exam. Not the, well, I didn't give you the answer. You've got, well, this one, you don't get this one wrong, all right? here are the questions, and then there you have to figure out what the answer is. Canvas may swap them. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. And then here are the three answers and the, I'm sorry, the questions and the answers for hybrid securities from chapter 18. Okay. All right. So we've got 5 minutes left. Any ideas? What do you want to do? Go back and see how we're doing, or hey. Oh, well, we were only down 9%. Now we're down 9.69%. See, this is dangerous. Going and checking every day, every 15 minutes, how your mutual funds or your stocks or whatever are doing. So, okay. So I hate to let you go early, because I feel that you paid your money. Are you getting an education? Let me stop the share and let's ask. Let's take a look at the chat. Are you getting an education? Are you getting an education about investments? Says Andrew. Do you feel more confident about choosing investments? Are you getting education? Yes, says Nicholas. Yes, because that's the key, right? That's the, apart from the grade you're getting, do you feel that you now see the stock market as a whole with more clarity? Bonds, I know, are kind of boring, and choosing mutual funds. I hope so. I hope so, because the news is good. Yeah, right. That's the idea. Because we got, Alejandro says he's learned more about investments these past couple of months than he had in his whole life. Why is that? Because on the television, on the internet, they got about 3 minutes or so before people lose interest, right? And so they just go through something very cursorily, and they, never really get a good idea of the actual company underneath that's investing. And they don't compare them to their competitors, I find. So they're more interested in just getting people to, click on their advertisements and their next surefire get rich quick scheme. Good. I'm very happy to hear these things. Very happy. And if you're not, I want to hear that too. I mean, if you don't feel like you feel like oh, it's too much or it's too little, because I'm always torn between whether we're giving too much information or too little. The reason why we keep hammering the constant perpetual growth model, the discounted cash flow model, is because if you can do those two, specifically the discounted cash flow model, if you can do that one, you can do anything. There are many other different models that you could learn, the cash flow and just, they're all different types of things that you can do. But if you can do that discounted cash flow model, then you really can look at anything. You can look at a bridge. Yeah. Well, does bridge make us money? You can look at a water purification plant. You can look at a pizza shop. You can look at anything that's generating, any investment that's generating. Yeah, I know what to buy this month and next month and so on, thanks to dollar cost averaging. Right, dollar cost averaging is so easy. That's the best part. You don't have to worry about what's going to happen next month. You don't care. You hope it goes down. Yeah, I hope it goes down, because then I'll get more shares. So good. Thank you so much. All right, so let's remind everybody, exam number 4 this week. Contact me for help. Hope to see you tonight, but we'll record the worksheet number 3 session using Zoom, so you can go back on the website. You'll see it on the website, and be awesome, dear students. Okay, so I'll stick around for a few minutes.
Take care, Frank.
All right, Andres, take care, everybody. Say goodbye. And I'll
So when's the test exactly? Is it going to be this week?
Yes, it's this week. It starts tonight. The exam starts tonight and will be available until Sunday.
All right, thank you.
Sure. And, of course, contact me. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye. Cool. I'll stick around. So let's stop recording. All right. Where's that record button? There it is.
Recording has stopped.